This is Only a Game. I'm Nora Princiati. I think it makes sense to start this week's show by quoting my boy William Shakespeare, R.I.P., more specifically a little play called Romeo and Juliet. You may know it, as I do, as the source material for a little ditty called Love Story by Taylor Swift, but I digress. In Act 2, Scene 2, one of my personal faves, Juliet says to Romeo, "What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other word would smell as sweet." Well, I'm sorry, Juliet, and I don't mean to pile on because I know you're dealing with a lot right now, but you're wrong. Names do matter, and Only a Game's Matthew Stock has the story to prove it.
Jesse and Emily Cole were at a friend's wedding in New Jersey when the COO of their business called with bad news.
Jesse, we just overdrafted our account. We're completely out of money.
For the first time, really, we had completely failed. I mean, how do you run out of money and not have a backup plan?
A few months earlier, Jesse and Emily had bought a collegiate summer league baseball team in Savannah, Georgia. They had already taken on millions of dollars in debt, and opening day was still months away. On the drive home from New Jersey to North Carolina, Jesse and Emily talked about what they could do to keep their new team afloat. And Emily came up with a plan.
She turned to me, she said, "We have no other options. We have to sell our house."
It was in the back of our minds the whole drive, but it took me saying it for us both to accept that that was really our only option left. We were not ready to give up on this.
This was not Jesse's first experience with a failing baseball team. In 2008, as a 23-year-old bachelor, he was hired as the general manager of the Gastonia Grizzlies.
I showed up that first day. The team was only averaging a couple hundred fans a game. I found out that the team had lost over $100,000 the previous year, and I found out that there was $268 in the bank account.
Right away, Jesse started calling local businesses to drum up sponsorships. Most weren't interested, and some had never even heard of the Grizzlies.
I was like, what have I got myself into? I mean, the team had been there, but nobody cared.
So Jesse went to the team owner with a new idea.
Ken, we can no longer be a baseball team. We need to be a circus, and maybe a baseball game will break out. And luckily, he didn't fire me, and he said we got nothing to lose.
Jesse called a group of his college friends, and they started brainstorming ideas to draw fans to Grizzlies games. Things were about to get crazy in Gastonia.
You know, we came up with Flatulence Fun Night, where we actually gave away whoopee cushions at the gate, and we had a farting contest on the field, a bean burrito eating contest. Salute to Underwear Night. If anybody wore their underwear on the outside of their pants and came in, they got a free ticket. George Bush was the president and his term was over. So what do? We offered him an internship.
Jesse also brought the players into the fun. They started handing out programs before warmups and doing choreographed dances in between innings.
It started getting a lot of buzz, and that's when the attendance started skyrocketing. It really became bigger than we even imagined.
People started hearing about Jesse and the Grizzlies. Among them was a young woman named Emily McDonald.
My boss at the time heard Jesse speak at a conference, and she actually left the room and called me and said, "I met the guy that you're going to marry."
Emily was working for a minor league baseball team in Augusta, Georgia. Like Jesse, she also believed that fan-centric entertainment was the secret to success in baseball. The two started exchanging emails, and sure enough,
over time, just kind of got to know each other and fell in love, and then I ended up moving to Gastonia and working for the team with him. I will always remember the first time I walked into that Gastonia ballpark. Jesse was teaching the players the Thriller dance on the field. In a tuxedo, by the way. He was in a black tuxedo. We were having a blast from the first moment that I stepped foot in that stadium.
And just a few months later, Jesse stopped a Grizzlies game between innings, brought the entire staff out onto the field, and dropped to a knee in front of Emily.
I had the ring inside a baseball, which I carved open, and I proposed to her.
Emily said yes, which cued a 30-minute fireworks display before play could resume. To continue the celebration, the couple planned a weekend trip to Savannah, Georgia. Neither of them had been before. And of course, one of their first stops was a minor league game at Grayson Stadium.
We walked into this ballpark and we fell in love.
Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and Hank Aaron all played there.
We could feel the history and the character coming out of it. This beautiful brick, huge archways. I mean, it was gorgeous.
But when Jesse and Emily looked around the grandstands, they realized the place was almost completely empty.
It was a beautiful ballpark on a beautiful night, and the whole atmosphere was just sad.
Ever the optimists, the couple marveled at Grayson Stadium's potential.
What an awesome opportunity if this place ever was available to bring life back to this ballpark.
And it didn't take long for Savannah's minor league team to offer that opportunity.
Within the next year, we heard that they couldn't draw fans, they couldn't have success in Savannah, they needed a new stadium, and the city wouldn't build them a new stadium, and they were leaving.
Jesse and Emily had bought a majority share of the Gastonia Grizzlies earlier that year, and they had just put the finishing touches on their dream house.
We built a fire pit, a bar, we had a hot tub back there. It was the hangout place.
But Grayson Stadium was up for grabs, and the newlyweds couldn't resist. In 2016, they bought their second franchise in the Coastal Plain League and began building a new team in Savannah.
We started calling everyone in this community. We're here. We're going to do baseball right. We're going to make it fun. We're going to have tons of entertainment. And what happened? Crickets. I mean, nothing. No one believed us.
Jesse says the team sold just one season ticket in its first 2 months. They were hardly bringing in any money. So after that phone call,
we're completely out of money.
Our only option left.
We have to sell our house.
Jesse and Emily sold their dream house and moved to Savannah. From there, they put every penny they had into the team, even if it meant that their new living arrangements were a significant step down.
I actually went and looked at this duplex first, and it was horrible. I mean, disgusting.
The nastiest, most decrepit, worst fixer-upper place.
I opened the door and take him in, and he just shook his head no and ran back out. But after talking it through and realizing that this is truly all we could afford, we decided to buy it.
We slept with our socks on because the floor was so disgusting.
We had to lift one leg up and over the toilet in order to sit down because your knees were touching the wall.
One night, my wife woke up screaming, and there was a cockroach on my face. We didn't want to tell people closest to us how much we were suffering and struggling. We hadn't even named the team.
Jesse and Emily believed that a great team name could turn things around. They announced a naming competition in the local newspaper for fans to submit suggestions. Jesse and Emily wanted something unique. No generic animal names or weather phenomena. Something for Savannah to unite behind. Over 1,000 people wrote in, but one submission stood out. The Savannah Bananas. The ideas came quickly.
This could be great. We could have a mascot named Split. We could have a senior citizen dance team called the Banana Nanas. We could have a promotion where we throw bananas from the top deck and people catch it in their pants, and it's called Banana in the Pants. Our slogan could be Go Bananas. We came up with all the ideas and said we have to do it.
On February 25th, 2016, Jesse and Emily announced the new team name. Within minutes, the Savannah Bananas were number one trending on Twitter, and merchandise orders were flooding in from all over the country. But the Savannah community had a different response.
We got crucified. They were saying the owners should be thrown out of town. You guys are an embarrassment to this city. You'll never sell a ticket. Please leave our town. Who are you guys? Who do you think you are?
For the Bananas, however, all press was good press. The team sold out its opening night game.
I think a lot of it was people just saying, let me go check out these crazy people. They're probably going to fail. This is probably going to be a joke. But regardless, they bought the tickets and they showed up.
Over 4,000 fans arrived at Grayson Stadium for the Bananas' June 2nd season opener. For once, everything was going to plan. Until the rain came.
That's just what happens in the baseball world. Sometimes the gods are not in your favor.
A Savannah downpour that you would never, it was unbelievable.
The Bananas waited almost 3 hours to begin play. But even after the delay, their sellout crowd was still in their seats.
There was 4,000 people still there, waiting to watch the Savannah Bananas.
It was clear from the game itself that people weren't staying to see quality baseball.
I think we made 6 errors. We were letting up runs left and right.
They stayed for the show.
We have a breakdancing first base coach, a 30-piece pep band playing either Final Countdown or Rocky or Uptown Funk. It's a nonstop entertainment experience. Our scripts take hours to produce because every night it's a different script.
The Bananas sold out 18 games in 2016, their inaugural season. They even rebounded from that opening night loss to win the Coastal Plain League championship. Now, the Bananas are on a 60-game sellout streak. On the field, they finished 2018 with the league's best regular season record.
So many operators, they focus first on how do they make the best team. Well, we've realized it's the exact opposite. You focus on the environment, the fans, and then the baseball takes care of itself.
Jesse and Emily are renovating their dingy duplex in Savannah. They're almost done turning it into their new dream house. And even as the Bananas continue to sell out games and light up social media, their owners are still pushing the envelope when it comes to improving the game they love.
I believe baseball is too long, too slow, and too boring. As an owner of a baseball team, I feel that baseball is like a hot dog stand. And what we do is we are unbelievable at the condiments. We have great mustard, ketchup, relish, but the hot dog still needs work. And that's baseball.
Jesse and Emily Cole are now the parents of a 3-month-old baby. And though they've already turned around 2 failing baseball franchises, they're not done yet.
People said, if you could have on your tombstone, Jesse, I bet you would say, what's next? Because I'm always trying to move to that next adventure.
Thanks to Only a Game's Matthew Stock for that story. This week, the Savannah Bananas lost to the High Point Thomasville High Toms in the second round of the Coastal Plain League playoffs. If you want to see the Bananas in 2019, we recommend getting your name on the wait list now. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Let's be real for a minute. I know you love Only a Game, but every once in a while, you might not be able to catch the whole show. Maybe you have a spin class or something. So why not subscribe to the Only a Game podcast? Here's a secret. It's the exact same thing as the radio show, but you can listen to it whenever you want. Like after spin class, or maybe before. You could listen to it during class. It could even be a good warm-up. In the summer of 1965, Wanda Fisher was a 16-year-old baseball fan who wanted to become a sports writer. But a major leaguer had some advice for her.
He said, you know, the guys really don't want women in the locker room or the clubhouse. They're going to give you a hard time.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Hey, Asma.
Hey, Scott.
Another crazy week. We've got North Korea.
Yep, we got Russia.
Midterms.
And, of course, President Trump. And what happens whenever there is crazy news that erupts? We pop into the studio and break it down to make sense.
So if you see a headline,
we've discussed it.
It's the NPR Politics Podcast.
I'm Nora Princiotti. It's time for 3 stories you should know. This week, we're going to talk about the president, the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and an RV. I'm joined by SB Nation's Tyler Tynes. Hey, Tyler.
What's up?
And by ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. Hello, Don.
Hello, Nora.
Tyler, we're going to go to you first.
So basically, obviously the talk of the town has been that on CNN, LeBron James was sitting down for an interview with a new school that he was opening, and Don Lemon asked him if he would ever sit down with the president. He also asked him a variety of questions about the presidency, about how sports is a unifying factor, and so many other things. And it wasn't the best messaging from LeBron James because he sort of jumbled at least his understanding of how sports are with the actuality of the unification powers of sports. But that started another news cycle between the president while he attacks black athletes, to which he was saying that Don Lemon is stupid and that LeBron James is stupid and he prefers Michael Jordan. This is a thing that we're going to constantly see until Donald Trump is not president.
Yeah, clearly President Trump sees this as a winning issue. 2 players took a knee Thursday night in a preseason game. They were both Miami Dolphins. And yet Friday morning, Trump tweeted out twice about this issue. And before long, I think the president's tweets may outnumber the number of kneeling players. He told Jerry Jones last year, this issue lifts me. This is a culture war issue for him, a losing issue for the NFL. Trump is now in a position where this gets traction with his base, and he's going to continue to try to provoke players to continue to take a knee and undercut the NFL.
So I think the parallel with the anthem issue, and it's almost ironic that I call it the anthem issue, is a good one because there is a jumbling of messaging in both cases. Because the thing about the anthem issue is that it took on this idea that it's strictly about the national anthem, which it never really was to begin with. It was about players protesting racial inequality and police brutality against minorities. And it struck me that there's kind of a similar sand trap in this debate with LeBron, potentially by design on the part of the president, which is that it's so easy to point out the good works that LeBron has done that a lot of people rushed to his defense by listing them. And in some ways, that's kind of beside the point because LeBron's support of his community really shouldn't be up for debate. And putting it up for debate kind of loses the important point here, which is that the president seems unable to tolerate black athletes who have success and are comfortable exercising their strength and their own personal agency.
I just think the point here is not to jumble so many of these different factors. It's great that LeBron James opened a school, but that by itself has to be unpacked and repurposed, and we need to make sure that's all good. At the same time, when the president attacks black athletes, it's improper to think that we shouldn't have the conversations. Black people are being disproportionately murdered by police. We're still unequal to white people at almost every single level of this country. And other people of color are going through the exact same thing by different measures and standards. And so the reality of the situation for us is that these are not conversations for us. This is life or death for us. It doesn't matter if the president is going to respond to every player that is kneeling or protesting because it is expected at this point because it's policy for him. The difference has to be that we actually dig into the nuances of why they are still kneeling years later. Is it because Colin Kaepernick has a job? Absolutely. But it's specifically for the reason that people are still being murdered. That's going to always be the prevailing issue for the people that are actually affected. This lackadaisical approach to not addressing what the president says or being fed up by what the president says, that's great for white people only, but it's not great for the people who are actually affected by what's going on.
So Don, I'm going to turn things over to you and insist that you make a speech now.
Well, Terrell Owens skipped the Pro Football Hall of Fame enshrinement ceremony last weekend. The wide receiver's gold jacket was flown down to him in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where he hosted a ceremony on the University of Tennessee campus. T.O. got into the hall on the third ballot, but he felt, and many others agreed, that he should have been a first ballot Hall of Famer and that the voters considered non-football factors like his character to keep him out the first 2 years. Owens was the first inductee to skip the weekend of festivities in Canton, Ohio, and this made the Hall of Fame brass very angry. So now, according to ProFootballTalk.com, the Hall of Fame is considering a requirement that all Hall candidates submit a written promise to attend the enshrinement ceremony before they're even officially voted in. I ask you guys, how dumb is this? You don't need to show up to collect an Oscar, a Grammy, an Emmy, a Pulitzer Prize, a Congressional Medal of Honor, or even a Purple Heart. Bob Dylan famously blew off the Nobel Prize, folks. And now we have the Hall of Fame proposing to basically codify this new intangible. You have to pledge to come to our party or you can't get into the hall.
Well, all the coolest parties are the ones that you have to attend, right?
That's right. Yes.
Tyler, I'm curious to hear what you think first.
I mean, this is dumb, right? This is dumb. And the thing about how dumb it is that it's an NFL-specific, a football-specific type of dumb. Everything that's ingrained into the culture formatting of football within America is mostly dumb. And so, of course, the football's truest fans, a lot of them are going to be like, of course, you people should be forced to show up for an award we barely want to give you. Okay, dog, that's cool, right? So let's put that on the side. On the other side of this is that the Hall actually believes what they're doing isn't the most ludicrous thing ever. Terrell Owens is one of the most disrespected athletes we've seen across sports in the last maybe 20 years or so. He has some actual real gripes with the way that he has been treated, the people who are actually treating him this way, and the majority of white writers who have been writing about him as if he's subhuman, because that's exactly what we think of football to begin with and the players and the proceeds there. And so if that's always been the case, this should absolutely make sense from the system of football that's always been this ultra-conservative vehicle of kind of crap, right? We know it's dumb. They know it's dumb. But it'll probably still pass and still be dumb.
I agree with you. I think it is dumb. You know, I was surprised that they sort of didn't have the self-awareness to not do this and put that idea in a box to never be spoken of again.
Yeah, Nora, it was another opportunity that was seized quickly to make an example of Tio. Now, I know the NFL and Pro Football Hall of Fame are technically separate entities, but the board of the hall is made up of plenty of NFL-connected folks. And it's just another example of the NFL creating a stupid controversy. And not coincidentally, in fact, there's an African-American athlete who's outspoken at the center of the controversy.
I hope you guys are both sitting down for this one, because my name is Nora Princiati, and I believe in the 2018 Cleveland Browns.
You don't believe that. You know you don't.
So I would say that I am on the bandwagon, but that is the wrong vehicular metaphor to use. I believe in the Browns for one reason, and it is because of an RV. The Browns quarterbacks, so that's Baker Mayfield, Tyrod Taylor, Drew Stanton, and Brogan Roback, are sharing an RV as a sort of clubhouse during training camp. It is for quarterbacks only. Mayfield was in charge of procuring the RV before camp, and Roback, as the guy who's last on the depth chart, fluffs the pillows and he stocks the fridge with healthy snacks recommended by the team nutritionist. His idea of Pop-Tarts was turned down. So that tells me that Cleveland's got a well-rested, well-fed group at the most important position on the field. And I think, what more could you ask for? Now, you might say receiver help, but I'm choosing not to think about that right now. Besides, Mayfield looked great in the first preseason game, and we all know how much that means. So, Tyler, are you joining what I'm calling the RV-lution?
No. No one gets excited for the Browns or Cleveland. The only thing exciting in Cleveland the last few years is LeBron. So, Browns bandwagon's definitely not happening for me, but, you know, it's a cute RV, y'all. Enjoy that.
Don't give me that sass about my RV. You know, the one thing I will say, and without drawing, you know, a little bit too much out of this RV thing, is that there are situations in which you combine a number one overall pick and a veteran like Taylor who would really like an opportunity, and they don't want to spend time in confined spaces together. So you could, if you really wanted to stretch this out, which I obviously do, you could make some sort of argument for the leadership qualities of Taylor being at least willing and perhaps eager to spend time with Mayfield, bond. But mostly I just think the RV is fun and I like it.
I like the RV too. A writer on Twitter last week said that the RV is more luxurious than her apartment. Quarterbacks are royalty. We all know that. They sign the biggest contracts for the most guaranteed money and now they get the best RVs, even if you're wearing a Cleveland Browns jersey.
But I'm not getting excited for the Browns, Nora. I'm not getting excited for the Browns.
You know what? We're going to talk in January, and
when they haven't won 7 games?
If they win 6 games, I'm calling it all because of the RV. And that is my final statement. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been SB Nation's Tyler Tynes. Thank you, Tyler.
Yep.
And ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. Thank you, Don.
Thanks, Nora.
This next story spans more than 6 decades, but it ends up in the same place it began. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Oh ho, 3-2, one down, runners on first and second, the Red Sox leading 2-0.
In the summer of 1956, when Wanda Fisher was not quite 8 years old, she stumbled upon a Red Sox game on the radio.
The guys had these beautiful radio voices, you know, these perfect sounding voices. They didn't have Boston accents.
Fly ball hit deep to right. Jensen going way back.
Wanda tried to imagine a game, but she couldn't quite picture it. Sure, the diamond must have 4 sides, but what did the bases look like? So she asked her father to take her down to the field where the high school kids played.
Then the next time I listened on the radio, it made a lot more sense. By the time I was 10, I started to pick up some of the nuances. And then when I was 14, my mother allowed me to go with my friends to my first game at Fenway Park. And then it really got bad.
Well, tell me about that first game. I mean, had you been begging her for a long time to let you
go? Oh, yeah, because, you know, in order to get to Fenway Park from Weymouth at the time, you had to take a bus from Weymouth to Quincy, and then you had to take another bus from Quincy to Fields Corner, and then you had to take a train from Fields Corner to Park Street Station, and then you had to go upstairs and take a trolley. So that was a project.
The year was 1963. Wanda says bleacher seats went for $1, and kids under 18 could sit in the right field grandstand for 85 cents. But for their first time in Fenway Park, Wanda and her 2 friends paid $3 each for box seats.
And we just had so much fun. Just, we were so close to where the ball players were. And at the end of the game, we walked that bridge back to Kenmore Square and took the trolley, the train, and the 2 buses home. And it was just amazing.
After that, Wanda's mother let her go to the ballpark on her own, as long as she brought home a ticket and a completed scorecard to show that she actually had attended the game. Wanda's mom didn't know how to read a scorecard, but Wanda did. She learned from the best.
We always went for batting practice. We went early. I was filling out my scorecard with the lineups, and Kurt Gowdy, you remember who Kurt Gowdy was?
Kurt Gowdy.
And there's a long drive to deep right. That ball is gone.
He was the voice of the Red Sox from 1951 through 1966.
He came over to me and he said, "Do you know how to fill out that scorecard?" And I was like, "No." And he said, "Well, let me show you how we do it in the booth." And he showed me how to draw this little diamond and how to put in when a person hit a single and if they were caught stealing and all this other stuff. And he said, "Now, the next time I see you, I'm going to make sure you're doing it right." you know, I was petrified. I thought he was going to come back and, you know, give me 40 lashes or something if I did it wrong. And he came back a few weeks later when we were at batting practice, and he looked down and he said, "How's it going?" And I said, I think I'm doing good. And he said, "Okay, well, show me." And I showed him. He goes, "You're doing fine. Yeah, you're doing good." I just thought that was absolutely fabulous, you know, that Kurt Gowdy taught me how to score, and he gave me an A.
So that must have really inspired you to keep going.
It did. Yeah, it did.
Along the way, Wanda got the idea that maybe she could be more than just a fan of her beloved Red Sox. After all, she was a good writer. Her first letter to the editor, praising the local lifeguards, was published when she was in the second grade.
I thought, you know, I would really like to be a sports writer, and I think that I could do it even though I'm a woman.
Wanda went to the library and looked through the index cards to try to figure out if there were any women writing about sports. She found a few, but not many.
My mother said, "You might as well try to be president than be a woman sports writer." And I said, "Well, maybe I should try to be president. I don't know, you know."
When she got to high school, Wanda started writing about baseball for the school newspaper. She compared her articles to the ones the boys were writing. She thought hers were better. Then came the summer of 1965.
Neither one of my friends, who was one of my baseball companions, was available to go to the game, so I went by myself.
Wanda stayed until the very end of the game. She mingled in the players' parking lot, getting autographs. And as she was leaving, she spotted Rick Reichert.
And I said, "Oh, aren't you the center fielder for the California Angels, Rick Reichert?" And he said, "Well, yes, I am."
Wanda and Rick were headed across the bridge to Kenmore Square. Rick was on his way to his hotel. Wanda needed to take the trolley to the train to the two buses that would take her home.
I said, "My goal was to be a sports writer," and I remember him actually stopping walking. And I think it was because he knew I was going to get on the train if we kept walking.
And he wanted to make sure that he got his message.
He wanted to make sure I got the point.
That's when Rick Reichert, center fielder for the California Angels, told Wanda Fisher, 16-year-old from Weymouth, Massachusetts, something that would change the course of her life.
"You know, you seem like a really nice girl." He said, "You know, the guys really don't want women in the locker room or the clubhouse, and they're going to give you a hard time. I don't want to say don't do it. I'm just telling you that this is what you're going to be up against." And I thanked him, and he went to the Kenmore Hotel where the ballplayers stayed, and I went down into the subway to get on the trolley.
On the long ride home, Wanda thought about what Reichert had said. She decided to follow his advice and not pursue a career in sports writing. Later, when Jim Boughton's book, Ball 4, came out, and she read about what went on in baseball's clubhouses, she knew she had made the right choice.
I would not have been able to handle the kind of language, let's say, that I was not used to hearing at my house when I was growing up. I just wouldn't have been able to do it.
It's interesting that you feel that way, because on the one hand, you are describing yourself as this very opinionated child, as a very independent child, not an afraid child at all.
Well, I fought with the boys all the time when I was in school, but I would go home and cry about it because they made fun of me, you know. But how much of that could you take if it was constant by grown men whom you'd idolized all your life?
Wanda had a long and rewarding career in public relations and marketing. She says she's proud of all the women she sees on TV talking about sports. But she definitely did not go to work every day wishing that she had become a sports writer.
What I realized over the past 40 years is that most likely, had I not taken that advice and I tried to break in through that glass ceiling that existed in the late 60s, early 70s, I probably would have hated sports. And if I had hated sports, my life would have been completely different. Where would I be?
Wanda doesn't live near Boston anymore, but she's still a fan of the Red Sox. And on August 5th, 2012, when the Sox hosted the Minnesota Twins, she got the chance to audition to become the public address announcer at her beloved Fenway Park.
Batting second, the left fielder.
It was basically the thrill of my life to be up there in that booth and say things like, "Now batting number 15, the second baseman, Dustin Pedroia." You know, I mean, that was amazing. That was amazing. And if I didn't love baseball still, I wouldn't have done that.
Recently, Wanda Fisher published her first book, a novel set in baseball. One of the characters is a minor league ball player who grew up in Weymouth, Massachusetts, two buses, a train, and a trolley ride from Fenway Park. When the novel was finished, Wanda sent a copy to Rick Reichardt.
I did. I found him through Facebook.
And did he respond?
No, he didn't respond to me yet, but I do expect to hear from him.
I mean, you sound like you're thankful for the advice that Rick gave you
that day. I am thankful. You know, sometimes I will just be driving by a field and I'll see a Babe Ruth game and I'll pull over and I'll watch it for a few innings and somebody next to me will say, which one of those kids out there is your grandson? And I'll be like, none of them. I just want to watch these guys for a few innings. You know, I just love this game. I don't know. I can't explain it.
That story came from Only a Game's Karen Given. Wanda Fisher's novel is called Empty Seats. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Kansas City Athletics owner Charles O. Finley treated his mule, Charlie O., better than he treated his players.
Charlie O. had a beautiful trailer. You know, it was green and gold with Charlie O. the mule painted on the side. And he had an air-conditioned trailer. And we had buses that had no air conditioning in it.
Coming up, that story and more from baseball lifer Ken Harrelson. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Did cutting taxes actually grow the economy?
And what makes DJ Khaled the king of pop music?
The Indicator, a daily podcast where we tackle the big economic questions.
I'm Nora Princiati. Coming up next week on Only a Game, how softball and not baseball became the diamond sport for girls and women. But now, the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Nora.
The NCAA announced a list of reforms Wednesday, and one new rule would allow high school and college basketball players who have been deemed, quote, elite, unquote, to hire agents. Another would allow college athletes who don't get drafted to return to school. Do we have to hold our noses and give the NCAA credit for this one, Charlie?
No, because the fundamental inequity of major college basketball still exists, namely that all of these rules are designed to keep you from having to pay the hired help. These are rules that were put through with apparently no input from either the NBA or USA Basketball, even though one of the rules assigns a new responsibility to USA Basketball that USA Basketball doesn't even want. This is the NCAA going rogue because it's being caught up in an FBI investigation that's almost as ridiculous as the NCAA itself. They can't get out of their own way on this.
So a couple hundred Ohio State fans, including the father of Cowboys running back Ezekiel Elliott, gathered outside the team's stadium earlier this week for a rally in support of head coach Urban Meyer. Now, Meyer is on paid administrative leave during an investigation of what he knew about domestic abuse by one of his assistants. So what I'm wondering, Charlie, is what could possibly lead these people to believe that Meyer is the victim here?
Football! You know what football does to the human mind. Football twists the human mind, especially the male human mind, into all kinds of different weird shapes. And I don't mean physically on the field. I mean as a fan. Places like Columbus, Ohio, and as we learned, State College, Pennsylvania, and 100 other places, the coach literally can shoot somebody in the main street in the campus quad, and you'll get a rally together supporting him because he won 8 games last year.
Staying on football, a little birdie told me, Charlie, that this is your favorite time of the entire sports year because you love NFL preseason games more than anything else in sports.
You mean exhibition games? yes, and what an exhibition they were. I'm looking at a list of the passing leaders from Thursday night, and I know most of these guys, but the reason that I know them, Brandon Whedon, Colt McCoy, is they're all freaking retreads.
It's like 2011.
I mean, Baker
all over
Mayfield.
Again.
Okay, I've heard about him. He had a pretty good night. Carolina started some guy named Taylor Heinicke. I don't know who that is, but he threw for 121 yards. The whole list of leaders is made up of guys who, at best, will be playing arena ball in 2 years.
So the Boston Red Sox are on pace to win at least 110 games, and they recently completed a 4-game sweep of the hated Yankees. Will they ever lose again, Charlie?
I don't know, but they're beating people like drums right now. Their bullpen is pretty average, but it doesn't matter because they're hitting the hell out of the ball.
The AL East race is just about over. Are there any other divisional races that you've had your eye on?
I like the fact the Oakland A's are in contention because I have absolutely no idea how they're doing it. But they're a very, very good baseball team, and now they're in the playoff hunt for sure. And once again, the move of the Houston Astros to the American League has changed everything because the Houston Astros came to the American League just as they were getting really good.
Sad news from the hockey world, Charlie. Chicago Blackhawks great Stan Mikita died Tuesday at the age of 78. Do you have any good Stan Mikita stories for us?
Well, not particularly Stan Mikita. I just remember Stan Mikita as being overshadowed on all those Blackhawk teams by Bobby Hull because Bobby Hull had the big slap shot and the blonde hair, and he was the matinee idol kind of guy. Stan Mikita was the all-time workhorse, and Stan Mikita is now the all-time leading scorer for the Blackhawks, including Bobby Hull, with whom he played. He won Lady Bing twice. He was tough without being dirty. He was everything the 1960s and 1970s NHL was all about.
So we have what I like to call a Florida man story in this week's list. There was a South Florida golf pro named Tom Fleetwood who was surprised to see a six-figure direct deposit hit his Wells Fargo account last Friday until he realized that the PGA's European Tour had accidentally paid out prize money from the 12th-place finisher at the British Open. His name, Tommy Fleetwood. What are the odds?
The American Tom Fleetwood, who didn't win £120,000 at the recent British Open, has handled it pretty well, I think. All of a sudden, he looked in his bank account, and there was $154,000 in it. Right above a $14 transaction he made at Walmart.
And he said, "I'm a pretty laid-back guy." This is as told to golf.com. "Most people would be jumping up and down. I was like, meh."
Yeah. I mean, it has to be a mistake, right? I mean, you have to look at that amount and say something screwed up. Actually, no. You have to look at that amount and say, "I want a Benz right now."
Yeah, quick. Rush to the store.
I just remember the old Monopoly card. Bank error in your favor. Collect $100. Bank error in your favor. Collect $154,000.
PGA Tour error in your favor.
That's right.
So finally, Charlie, and I don't know how you guys missed this last week, but the Arena Football League's Washington Valor won the 2018 AFL title. So I'm assuming the Valor must have been great during the regular season, right?
Hey, first of all, in arena football, anything is possible, including the 2-10 Washington Valor going all the way through the playoffs and winning the Arena Football League title, largely because there are only four arena football teams left.
Yikes.
This is Roger Goodell and Pete Rozelle's golden dream. Every team in the playoffs, every team with a chance to win. Perfect parity.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. I find a great deal of his attitude in my Twitter mentions, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Nora.
The game isn't what it used to be. At least, that's what an older fan at Fenway Park told me after I bought a $10 can of spiked seltzer at the game the other night. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story of a guy who would agree, at least when it comes to baseball.
Ken Harrelson has the benefit of baseball hindsight.
The culture of the game of baseball was different in those days. There's no question about that.
For Harrelson, those days began in 1963. On the morning of June 9th, he was a first baseman for the minor league Portland Beavers, until he was woken by a 1 a.m. phone call.
"Son, pack your stuff, you're coming to the big leagues."
The caller was Charles O. Finley, the eccentric owner of the Kansas City Athletics. Soon Harrelson, the rookie nicknamed Hawk because of his bird-like profile, was hitting well against some of the best major league pitchers. On July 13th, in a game against the Cleveland Indians, he went up against one of the greatest of all time.
Early win, Gus was his nickname.
The aptly named Wynn was playing the last of his 23 big league seasons and going for his 300th career victory.
The first time up, he threw me a high slider, and I hit a rocket right back through the middle. Just missed his head, maybe foot and a half. So I get back to the dugout, and Bobby Del Greco was an outfielder in our club, and he comes over to me and he says, "Hawk," he says, "now the next time you face Gus," he said, "you better hang loose."
That was baseball speak for expect a knockdown pitch.
And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because there's two things you don't do against early wind. You don't bunt on him and you don't hit the ball back through the middle on him." He said, "Well, he's going to knock you right on your behind." I said, "That old fart ain't going to do anything." And sure enough, I go to the plate the next time. I tell you, first pitch was right behind my head. And my feet went straight up in the air and I landed on my shoulders.
Wim got his 300th victory. It was the last of his career. And Harrelson soon learned that he had perhaps a more troublesome opponent, Charlie Finley, the man who signed his paycheck.
The minimum salary back in those days, Gary, was $6,000. In fact, my first 2 years in the major leagues, I made more money shooting pool, playing golf, and arm wrestling than I did playing Major League Baseball.
Harrelson continued to play well as a rookie, but he felt he deserved more than the minimum salary. So he requested a meeting with Finley to discuss a raise. This was before the days of high-powered agents. One morning, after a successful road trip, Finley invited Harrelson to visit him in the fancy downtown Kansas City hotel where he lived.
And I just couldn't wait to see him. And I was saying to myself, you know, what's he going to pay? $10,000, $12,000, $15,000? So I walk into a suite, and he's got this table laid out with Danish and eggs and bacon and orange juice and milk and all that stuff. And I noticed, like a tube.
It looked like an empty paper towel tube.
He goes, come on in, son. He says, you had a pretty good road trip, but I'm going to show you what you've been doing wrong. And he goes over and he picks up this tube and he had a towel on the floor like a home plate. And my heart just sank because I knew that there was going to be no raise. And I was right because he didn't even broach the subject whatsoever.
2 years later, Finley gave him a chance to earn some extra dough at Yankee Stadium.
He said, I need somebody to ride Charlie O' the Mule around the warning track today.
Missouri Governor Warren Hearns had donated a mule to the A's. Charles O. Finley named it after himself.
Charlie O. the Mule was absolutely one magnificent animal. It's the biggest mule I've ever seen. He was gorgeous.
Finley saw an opportunity to market his team by taking his beautiful mule everywhere the A's played and asking his players to ride it. The A's didn't care to at first, but in New York, Finley finally put his money where his ass was.
And he says, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give whoever does it $25. So I stuck in my hand real quick. You know, when you're making $6,000 a year and you go to New York and start off, a 2 week road trip, and you're getting $10 a day meal money, I mean, New York can kill you.
Harrelson got the assignment.
So I jumped up on him and I put my bill of my cap up like a jockey's cap. And I started from home plate going down third base. And I come up on the Yankee dugout, and I see Roger and Mickey sitting in the corner.
That would, of course, be Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle.
Maris has got a fungo in his hand, and Roger throws this fungo and hits Charlie O in the ass, and he starts bucking. And I'm telling you what, I slipped underneath because there was no saddle or anything, and I'm staring him right in the face, and his teeth looked like they were 4 or 5 inches long, and my nose was long, so that was not a good matchup.
Harrelson had a big plug of tobacco in his mouth.
So I'm hanging on for dear life. And finally, his trainer comes running out. He says, let me get him. So he grabbed his mane. And he said, okay, jump off. So I let go. And when I did, I hit the ground. And I ran right to the dugout, right up in the runway, and started throwing up because I swallowed the whole chaw of tobacco. But I got the $25.
Soon Harrelson would learn how readily Charlie Finley would spend his money, only on his beloved mule.
In Detroit, we were staying at the Sheridan Cadillac, and he had them knock down a wall between two suites, and he had them put straw in there and everything else. Charlie O, the mule, had a suite, and we were sleeping two and three to a room. Plus, Charlie O had a beautiful trailer. You know, it was green and gold with Charlie O the Mule painted on the side. And he had an air-conditioned trailer. And we had buses that had no air conditioning in it. He treated him like he was royalty. And he treated the players like, you don't mean anything to me.
Yet, for all of Finley's issues, Harrelson did admire him for one thing.
Charlie was, let me tell you something about Finley. He had some really innovative and creative ideas. He really did. And he had some that were just off the wall. He was trying to attract fans to come to the ballpark because in those days, Kansas City, our club was not very good.
One of Finley's innovative ideas was to sign Negro League and barnstorming legend Satchel Paige to a one-game contract. On September 25th, 1965, Paige took the Municipal Stadium mound against the Boston Red Sox. Finley did not ask Paige to mind his mule, He actually went out of his way to make the pitcher comfortable.
He bought Satchel a nice rocking chair that they put down in the bullpen area. And so Satchel would sit in that rocking chair and rock back and forth through the game. The only hit he gave up was a double off the left center field wall to Yastrzemski on a 3-0 count. And it was amazing because Satchel was probably throwing 60 miles an hour.
Satchel Paige exited after three innings to a standing ovation. That game was his last as a major leaguer.
I went to him after the game, and I said, Satchel, I said, can I have your glove? And he said, sure. He gave me his glove. It was a Wilson A2000. And I kept that glove.
And then he lost it. It must really eat at you that you couldn't find that glove, huh?
Well, it does. Not for me, but for the Hall of Fame, for people to see it. You know, that was his last glove that he used in a major league game. He was just a unique, wonderful person. I'll never forget the time that I spent with Satch and the stories that he told me.
Ken Harrelson was released in 1967 by the Kansas City A's after the team fired manager Alvin Dark, and Harrelson called Finley a disgrace to baseball. The Hawk ended up on the pennant-winning 1967 Boston Red Sox. He ended his playing career in 1971 with the Cleveland Indians.
And to the outside. The ball hit high, Angie! Way back! Hey, look up! You can put it on the board! Yes! Yes! Hell yes!
Harrelson began a television broadcasting career in 1975. In his years as a player and television guy, he's seen a lot of baseball. When pressed, he steadfastly maintains that the game just isn't what it used to be. In fact, he says, it's a lot better.
I know there are a lot of guys in my age group that say, well, these guys are not as good as we were. Well, that's BS. These guys today are so much better in talent. They're bigger, they're stronger, they're faster, and they do things that we didn't even think about. That's one reason that I've stuck around a long time, because I've enjoyed it. I love baseball today more than I ever have.
Ken Harrelson, now 76 years old, will call 20 White Sox home games this season and then move into a new role as White Sox ambassador. He has his eye on a particular date, January 1st, 2020. That's when he hopes to join Vin Scully, Tommy Lasorda, Dave Garcia, and Don Zimmer as the only people who worked in baseball for parts of eight decades.
Gary, I wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't change a thing.
Only in Games' Gary Wallach spoke with baseball lifer Ken Harrelson for that story. Harrelson's new book is Hawk, I Did It My Way. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Gibbon. In our final word, Ken Harrelson admits that he didn't take it personally when Early Wynn floored him with a knockdown pitch.
You know, he said, if my mom were to get a hit off me, I'd knock her down too.
I'm Nora Princiotti. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.